Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is one of the few people that really has changed music. He's the inventor of the drum machine, Roger Lynn. First of all, let's talk about pirate radio. You know, this was something from the 50s and the 60s when we had Radio Caroline, Radio Luxembourg, and XERF out of Mexico. And these were huge stations. They were pirate stations. And for a long time, this is where music was discovered because there were no playlists, really. They played what they felt was really good. Now, that era came to a crashing close by the 90s, and we thought it was gone forever, but guess what? Pirate radio is rearing its head once again. And there's a couple reasons for that. The first is that there are immigrant communities that are underserved with radio as we know it. So, the Laotian community, for instance, or it could be the Mexican community, or it could be the Thai community, or any kind of communities that don't have their own radio stations locally. Pirate radio is just a thing for them to give them a touch of home, make them feel comfortable. That's not the only ones, though. With the recent change in royalty laws for internet radio, there is a lot of small broadcasters who had to give it up because it just cost too much money to license the music. And as a result, many of these are going back to traditional terrestrial radio. How can they do that? Well, it only costs about $750 to set up your own pirate radio station. And of course, it'll only be good for a few miles, but sometimes that's all you need to get started. One of the reasons why these are proliferating is because the FCC talks a big game, but really doesn't have the staff to crack down. So that's kind of interesting. The other thing is they're not much of a priority when it comes to the FCC's time and effort. So what we're seeing is these small pirate radio stations that are popping up all over the place. Now, the big thing that's catching the eye of the radio community is the fact that these small pirate stations, in many cases, are siphoning off advertisers that would normally be on the licensed AM and FM radio stations. And of course, it's tough enough in radio these days that this really suddenly comes on everybody's radar when there's somebody else taking the money. The other thing they say is that a pirate radio station can interfere with the emergency alert system. I don't know if that's the case at all, but it sounds good when you're trying to sell that to the public. And again, that's what the FCC is trying to do. One of the things is it's so cheap to set up your own pirate radio station that even if you get shut down, you can turn around and set up a new one if you have the $750 or so. So look out for more and more of this. Pirate radio is coming back. Who would have ever thought? If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions at bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new Brand Your Music Crash Course, as well as my 101 Mixing Tricks program and other online video courses. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is Basic Tracks Checklist. And this is kind of a common sense checklist that will make your basic tracking session go a lot smoother and hopefully get you better sounds as well. And again, this is very basic common sense, where if you just think about these things for a second and have them become part of your routine, you'll find that everything will just go a lot better. So, first thing, do the drums sound great acoustically in the room? If they don't, you gotta fix that, because no matter what you do in the control room, no matter what you do with microphones and preamps, if the drums don't sound good by themselves, you're in trouble. So this is the first thing. Second thing is, are the drums tuned properly? Now, again, you can have a great set of drums. If they're not tuned, then really you're in the same boat. You're kind of fighting it right from the beginning. And I've found through the years that many drummers don't know how to tune their own kit. They can sort of do it, but they really don't know what they're looking for, and they especially don't know how to tune it for recording. So if that's the case, get someone in, hire them, someone that knows how to tune the drums. It's worth paying the money because it's going to sound so much better. Next thing, is there a variety of instruments available? That means different guitars, different basses, different amplifiers, different keyboards. Again, if you have the same sound throughout a record, although that could be good in many ways, sometimes it's very boring as well. So it's nice to be able to change things up. Do you have a variety of snare drums available, for instance? Because sometimes a snare drum just doesn't work on a song, or one will work even better than what you're used to. So have a variety of instruments always ready. Are the instruments in top condition? It doesn't do you much good to have a variety of instruments unless everything is usable. So what does top condition mean? Well, when it comes to stringed instruments, it means everything is intonated well. It sounds good, you can get it in tune, maybe there's new strings on it. With drums again, new heads make a big difference. Anything to make things sound and work better is what you want. Now again, something that plays really well will make the part go better. So all of these are important. Are the players happy with the headphone mix? Boy, this is a big one. And when I first started, the engineer would take a whole lot of time trying to get this absolutely right. Now, this is in the days when there's only one mix or two mixes. And even today, where each musician can dial in their own headphone mix, it doesn't necessarily mean they know how to do that. So what I've found is it's best to go out and get a basic mix, show the musician what to change in order to make it more to their liking, then leave them alone. But it's important to get that basic mix together first, because if you leave certain musicians to their own devices, they're just not going to get it. Does the click sound right? If you're using a click, and let's face it, we do that a lot anymore, if you're going to use a click, do you have the right sound? And the right sound could be just a normal mechanical click, or it could be a cowbell or a go-go or anything like that that is comfortable to the drummer especially. So ask the drummer, what kind of sound do you want? That's where to start. The next thing is, does that click actually groove in the track? And this means, where's the downbeat placed? Is it placed on the quarter note, on the eighth note? Sometimes even adding a delay to the click can just make it feel better and groove a little better. And the better it grooves, the better the musicians are going to groove as well. Is the click bleeding? So, in other words, is it so loud that it's bleeding into the microphones? If everything is playing loud, this won't matter too much. On the other hand, if there is a soft or even a stop time during the song, then the click will just be out of control, which is no good either. This usually occurs with drummers especially, so this is the time to get them one of those isolation headphones like the Vic Firth that we see so many places. Did you set up a studio talkback mic, and is it turned on all the time? One of the things that musicians hate is if they're talking to you in a control room and you can't hear them, or you're not listening for them. And of course, what happens there is there's a lot of frustration that builds up. So it's worth it to put a talkback mic out and always turn it on right after the song ends, so you can hear everything that goes on the floor. The same thing with the control room talkback mic, because many times musicians can get very, very frustrated if they don't hear what's going on. They don't hear the conversation in the control room. You may be talking about something that is completely disconnected to what's happening in the studio, but they don't take it that way. As a matter of fact, usually they think you're talking about something that's negative to them. And of course, nobody kind of likes that. So it's best to turn that talkback on right after the song ends and have everybody listen to what's going on in the control room as you listen to what's going on in the studio. So these are just a few of the things that you can do to make your basic tracking session run better. Of course, they're all common sense, like I said before, but just getting into the habit of a few of these things or all of these things will really make your session go a lot smoother and be a lot more efficient. My guest today is Roger Lynn, who truly changed the music business when he created the first drum machine with digital drum samples in 1980 with his LM1. He followed that model up with the Lynn drum, Lynn 9000, and then helped Akai create the hip-hop standard with the MPC series. In 2001, Roger created the very cool Adrenaline series of guitar pedals for his Roger Lynn Designs company, and recently created a brand new type of 3D controller with his Lynnstrument. I spoke with Roger via Skype from his office in the Bay Area. So everybody knows you from the tech side, but you have a big history as a songwriter and as a musician prior to the Lynn drum and everything like that. Let's start there. So you have a number of hit records to your credit as a songwriter. Very cool.
Well, a few. I think I'm mostly lucky. The biggest break I got was the Eric Clapton song in 1979 called Promises. which I wrote with your friend Richard Feldman.
Yeah.
And it was, I never thought it was that great a song, but Richard knew Eric Clapton's drummer at the time, and so we got a nice little in, and it was just a marvelous windfall. And that was, geez, that 79, I was 24 when they came out. I think we wrote it when I was around 22.
Mm.
So it was marvelous, and it really helped with the process of being a starving musician.
But you had others, too. You had Quitting Time, right, with Mary Chapin Carpenter?
Yeah, Mary Chapin's Carpenter's first hit, Quitting Time, and that was also a co-write. I don't really write lyrics. I'm more of just a music guy. And I wrote it with a guy named Rob Royer, who was a member of the band Bread and also has an Oscar for a song he wrote. Let's see, it was for the movie. The song was called For All We Know, and I forgot what year that was, but it was for the movie Lovers and Other Strangers. And I think it was sometime in the 70s. So he's had some great success with that. And we wrote it first. I had a track that I had given to Rob, and then he wrote lyrics to it, and we made a new demo out of it. And it was first on an album by a singer named Lou Ann Barton. And then I think it was either Mary Chapin Carpenter or her producer, John Jennings, who noticed it and liked it when she was making her first album, and they recorded it, and then they picked it as the first single. So it was very nice. That's when they used to pick songs for singles, right?
Yeah, funny how that works. Huh? A little different now. Yeah. Okay, so, but you were a guitar player first, right? And you played with Leon Russell, correct?
I did. And actually, even as a guitar player, I was sort of a bargain employee, because not only when he went on the road would I play guitar, but when we were in the studio, I would act as recording engineer. And also, I was a real dweeb, and I knew about all the gear, particularly synthesizers, and he wanted to get into that. And so I was sort of a package deal, and I worked cheap, so it was great for him. And Leon is he's a frugal person, so it helped him.
Yeah, I've heard. I had Jamie Oldacre on the podcast a few months ago, and he gave me some stories like that as well with Leon.
Well, it was Jamie who was playing drums with Clapton at the time who got our song Promises, the demo, to Eric Clapton.
Yeah. So
he was very, very helpful and much appreciated.
Jamie also told me the story that he thought was the impetus for the drum machine. And what he said was, he was in the studio and you were engineering with Leon, and something came up he said you were using one of the old drum machines, the beat boxes, right? And someone said, if only this had real sounds. And he said, the light bulb went off. He saw the light bulb going off. So did that happen? What's the reality there?
Well, I don't remember that particular incident, but that probably is correct. The concept of digital sampling was already around. Most revolutions, if you look at them closely, are evolutions. And most overnight successes usually take about 20 years. Well, in this case, it was already known, the concept of digital sampling. And there was already a synthesizer, I think at the time, from Roland, that was called the D70, or maybe it came afterward, but they used little tiny snippets of samples at the beginning of sounds to add the realism, whether it was the blip of a trumpet or the pick of a guitar or the shift of a flute, and that created that realism that makes your ear think that there's something real. And I think that was out before the Lindrum. And so there were little ideas here, and then there were two digital tape recorders. What I mainly did was, I just came out with a digital drum machine. I recognized the fact that even though sampling memory was very expensive, all I needed to sample was one bass drum and one snare drum, and these were about a quarter second long, or at the time, maybe. I think my samples were an eighth of a second long. And so I didn't need much memory. I would just have the computer inside saying, play bass drum, play snare drum, play bass drum, snare drum, and that would make it a beat. And so it was a great way of compressing the sampling time. I think the main thing I did was just to do it before it was economically viable. My first drum machines were $5,000. And I think there were probably other companies that recognized that this is something that they could do, but they were going to wait until it came down to maybe below $1,000, And so I think I was just, it was a lucky break in timing, and it all happened to come together very well.
Yeah, but you didn't know anything about manufacturing, though, when you started, did you?
Oh, yes, as anyone who bought one of my first drum machines can tell you. there were all kinds of problems. I remember getting a call from Stevie Wonder's tech. They were playing down in Australia, and the LM1 drum computer, my first drum machine that he had, had just broken. And I was telling the guy to swap out some chips and see which ones would work. And he happened to be able to find a chip down there in Australia that worked. You
know? Wow. Wow.
But no, it was all very frenetic. I didn't really know too much about what I was doing. Even as an engineer, I wasn't a real engineer. I had no training in engineering. I had just read some books. And so I largely stole circuits from computers and other, you know, early digital circuits at the time, and put it all together. But the first LM1 was not engineered so well, and I had to change a few things as time went by to improve some of the flaws of my own engineering design. You know,
where did you get the samples?
Well, the samples, actually, keep that thought, because there was something came to mind. You had asked about the impetus of the idea for the drum machine. Yeah. And I think if anybody should be credited for that, it's the guy I worked with at the time, Leon Russell. Leon had actually been talking to Mr. Kakahashi, the founder of Roland, about making a programmable drum machine. It was with the standard synthesized sounds. But he actually had talked to Kakahashi, and he had received some drawings from Kakahashi about what the drum machine would look like or something like that, a programmable machine. But when I actually started working with Leon Russell, I hated drum machines because they all sounded so cheap. And, you know, these are the sort of things you'd find in home organs at the time, right?
Yeah.
And so that was the last thing I would ever use on what I would consider to be a creative recording. But Leon would use drum machines, and for a very good reason. He would use them to keep the time steady on the recording. And that way, if he didn't like the drummer's part, he could write the drummer off and put another drummer on.
Yeah.
Whereas if you record with a drummer and the drummer's time is not so good, then you've got to try to match the poor timing of the drummer. And so I really learned a lot from him about all aspects of production. I mean, I was 19 at the time when I worked with him, and so it was a great experience for me. And he was really a good idea person, and he didn't and he used things in new ways, and like the drum machines, and it was a great learning experience for me. But I would say that had I not worked with Leon, I would not have come up with that idea to make a programmable drum machine. Now, of course, I went later and improved it and made a real-time operating system that people seemed to like, and the sampled sounds, but his it was his thoughts that really were the genesis of the idea.
Yeah, but getting the idea for it and actually following through to make it a reality are two different things. We all have ideas about things, but making them real, you know, that's a complete other step.
Well, and thank you for that. I mean, I did do some good stuff, but I thought it was just important to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah, yeah.
He was very, very helpful to me. But anyway, you were asking about where did I get the sounds?
Yeah.
Well, when I was first doing this, I was very, very cheap. And so there was a guy I knew named Art Wood, and he was a drummer in L.A. and who had toured with Gary Wright. Remember him? And
Yeah, sure.
He had done a stint with Peter Frampton on tour at the time. And he played with a number of other people. He was a very good drummer. He was an ex-housemate of mine. And so I just had him over to bring some drums over and record them. But, you know, it's funny, a lot of people, there were a lot of rumors going around at the time of my first drum machine about who the drummer was. Some people said it was Jeff Porcaro. People said it was Steve Gadd. People said it was this person or that person. And the truth is, it didn't really matter who the drummer was so much, because all they had to do was come in and strike the drum once.
Yeah, right.
And the sessions were really funny. In fact, later, I had some other people help me out, some friends like Stan Lynch, who was in Tom Petty's band.
Sure.
And we did this at a studio in Hollywood. And so we were just laughing our heads off, because Stan came in and he tuned his drum up. We mic'd it and it sounded good. Said, okay, we're ready to go, Stan. And he'd hit it once. And I say, thank you very much. We'll call you. So it was one of the easiest sessions to do, you know. But yeah, that's the truth. All you need to do is really strike the drum very well once. But you needed to know how to tune it properly. And then it had to be mic'd properly to get a good sound.
Yeah.
But then again, to try to save sampling memory, I wanted to record the sounds dry without the long reverb tails. And I thought, well, you can always add the reverb tails, but if that's going to triple the length of the recording, it would make it a lot more expensive.
Sure.
So Art really provided almost all the sounds initially. And then what I did is I had a policy where if people started saying, you know, I like your sounds, but I'd like to be able to use my particular snare drum or my particular kick, could I send you a tape of that? And I say, sure. In fact, I'll do it for free if you'll just allow me to add your recording to my library of sounds I'm providing to users. And so I got a lot of great sounds that way, and it allowed me to save some money. And they were keen on it because they got their sounds for free. And at one point, actually, Daryl Dragon, who was the guy who was the captain of Captain Tennille,
sure.
But he was quite a good producer and got some very good sounds. And he had a very good studio, Rumba Recorders. I think it was in Chatsworth at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he recorded a snare drum, and it was a particularly good all-around snare drum. So for a while, I think in the Lindrum, I was using that snare drum. I don't know if I ever told Daryl about this. I'll mention it to him sometime.
Very cool. Okay, so you went from the Lindrum, and then you did some work with the Kai with the APC.
MPC, yes.
MPC, I'm sorry.
Yes, well, what happened was I had my company from 1979 to 1986, and it finally went out of business, largely due to my extraordinarily poor business management skills. But at any rate, when it went out of business, I was then looking at what to do next, and the Akai company approached me, and they were just starting out in musical products. At the time, they were a consumer electronics company. They were making, you know, stereos, TVs, things like that. And so a friend of mine who had a dealer in London that was very popular for selling my drum machines, they were called Syco Systems, S-Y-C-O.
Oh, sure.
And the guy who founded the business, his name was Stephen Payne. Anyway, he knew the guys who were setting up the new Akai Professional, which was the musical instrument division, and he saw that it would be a good opportunity, and so he connected them with me, and we talked, and it looked like it was a very good fit, because they would do all the stuff I was horrible at, all the business, the sales, the marketing, the manufacturing, and then I would just do the design part. And so and actually they even had a guy in London who would design the sound chip for us. And then I and my software team in LA would do all the design and then provide the software for it. So it was a very good fit. and it just so happened that these MPC machines, not only did they get used in a lot of rock records, the first one was released in 1988, but they became very popular, quite to my surprise, and in this burgeoning field of hip-hop recordings. And it became the standard machine to have. Yeah. In all those hip hop recordings. In fact, it was interesting because sometime around the early to mid 90s, I was called by a law firm to be an expert witness in a copyright infringement suit between two rappers. One of them was Sir Mix-a-Lot, who, if you recall, had a very popular record called Baby Got Back.
Yeah, yeah.
About women with rather large behinds. And so he was being sued by an earlier rapper. And so it turned out the backing tracks were almost, they actually were identical. And I think probably what happened was is that Sir Mix-a-Lot or whoever was doing his stuff there had gotten the sequence disc from the MPC 3000, one of my machines with a Kai, and just used it as the backing track for his song. Because, you know, there's no melody in a rap song. It's spoken word. Anyway, they were going to use me as an expert witness. And so first the law firm from Mix-a-Lot's lawyer called me, and then the first rapper called me, and they were fighting to get me as their expert witness. But it was hilarious because you listen to these two songs and there's no similarity in the lyrics. There's no melody, so there's nothing to copyright there. And the only thing that was similar was the backing track. And as you probably know, you really can't copyright a backing track.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But it was an essential part of the song, so it was kind of funny. Funny situation to be. They finally settled, so I didn't get to do it.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm sure you know this. I know you know it. You've influenced the way music has been made, the way it's been recorded, multiple genres. I mean, who else can say that? Not many people. That's pretty cool.
Well, the way I put it is that if somebody doesn't know what I do, and they ask me, I say, well, do you remember starting in the early 80s when there started to be these robot-like machines playing the drums on all the popular records. And at that time, as a result, music lost all of its soul, humanity, dynamics, rubato timing, and everything that we had come to appreciate before then. And they say, yes, I remember that time. I said, well, it's largely my fault.
But you know what? I tell people this all the time. I believe that it's also responsible for a new generation of better musicians. The reason why is they've grown up with that. They've grown up to playing with drum machines and with loops and everything. So their timing is so much better. Now, the feel is another thing, but their timing is so much better than it was when we were growing up, for instance, because that's not something that you thought about with the precision that you do now.
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, looking around at many of the people, the customers I deal with my new instrument product, or even with the Tempest drum machine I have, it seems that the whole concept of a musical note is becoming extinct in favor of loops and beats and sequences. In other words, people are all composing with a higher level of abstraction. Instead of learning those pesky things called notes or scales or chords or melodies or harmony, they don't have to bother with that. They can just take a recording of someone who spent all his life learning those things and take four bars of him, then take two bars of somebody else and put it together and say, hey, I'm creative too. So,
but it all cycles around again. So I'm sure we'll see the cycle follow through and in due time. Your drum machines have a better feel than everybody else's drum machines or sequencers that you get in a computer. Why is that?
Well, I think it's actually a myth. The one thing I did do in my early drum machines, I invented a feature called swing, where it basically delays for every eighth note, it delays the second 16th note within every eighth note, and in a variable amount of time. And that's another thing that I learned from Leon Russell about how different drummers play with different degrees of swing. And so I thought I can just do that in computer code and it make it so much easier to do. And so I think that helped a lot. But for example, Bruce Swedeen, you know, of course, was Quincy Jones' engineer and all those Michael Jackson records and many, many more. He claims on the Michael Jackson records, they often were just doing kick and snare and nothing else. And he claimed the feel was better. And I don't see how it could be. Yeah. I think part of it is that when people are using a DAW on their computer, a digital audio workstation, there's so many variables there. You know, for example, if they're using a sample, was the sample's beginning trim to be tight? Is there are there other things going on in the computer? Maybe they're slowing things down. Are they running through an interface that has a delay? Things like that. But I think anybody can get if they really have their system properly optimized. And if you buy a new Mac these days and just play it, I think it'll be just fine. But I don't think I had any advantage in that regard. I think the only thing would be is that the swing amounts, which other people finally caught on to a little bit later. But for example, some of the computer DAWs, they would make it hard to know which swing degrees to use. And I had everything set up so you could just play the beat and you could record a beat and would come back and loop around in just the right way. And I would make suggestions about the amount of swing that would help people. But of course, if you're a good musician, you can hear it. You know, you can hear it by ear. It's not so much. I think part of it, too, maybe is the fact that since my early machines were so expensive, the only people that had them were people who were working musicians who understood how to play music. And a lot of times, I think in later years, there were sort of two competing design standards for drum machines. One was the my machines, and the other one was Roland's 808 series and subsequent XOX. You know, 707 or whatever it was called, which was also excellent, but it was made for a different type of musician, one who doesn't really have the timing, and they needed to be able to turn on and off specific steps within a bar. And that made it easier if you don't have timing, But it's a whole lot slower if you do have timing.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So it seemed the people that embraced my machines and then later the my early machines and then later the MPCs were people who were already good musicians because they knew that real-time beat recording system was something that was easier for them to use and faster because they already had that talent. And so maybe it was just the fact that better musicians were using them. I don't know. It's hard to say. Maybe it's just that I got in there first, you know?
I don't know. I've felt it myself where it just felt better, always. And you try to duplicate that feel, and it just would never quite sound the same. There's something about the original Linn drums and then the MPC. There's just a feel thing to it.
Well, maybe part of it, too, there was this other feature I put in that I called note repeat, which has come to be known as roll in drum machines. And the idea of that was, actually, this was first used, well, it was in my earlier machines, like the LM1, the first one, and the Linn drum, the second one. But it really got to be very cool in the third one called the Linn 9000, where I had, for the first time, pressure-sensitive pads. And if you would record, for example, a hi-hat part and set it to 54% swing with 16th note timing correction and just vary the pressure as the beat records, it would record a bunch of little hi-hat notes with a loudness equivalent to the instantaneous velocity at that moment. So if you just vary your pressure on the pad randomly, you'd get a very natural varying of volume on the hi-hat, just like a drummer would do. And so I think that helped a lot too. And by the way, that was 1984. So pad pressure is not a new invention by Ableton and their Ableton Push. This big thing that people are now discovering, that's such a great improvement. I did that back in 1984.
Yeah. Well, you're an innovator in a lot of ways. Let's come up to the present. You started your own company again, and the first product was the Adrenaline.
That's correct.
Which was very cool. You talk about an effects box. There's nothing like it. How did you come up with the idea for that?
Well, you know, I hate to keep praising Leon Russell, but when we first worked together when I was 19, I had already worked with synthesizers, but they were packaged synthesizers like Mini Moogs or ARP 2600. But I had never really spent time on a full-fledged modular synthesizer. Well, one of the first things I did when I started working with Leon was I convinced him that he needed to buy a $20,000 modular synthesizer system from the EMU company. And so I would spend all my days and nights of free time down in the studio playing with this synthesizer. And one of the things that we loved to do was not to use the synthesizer always for playing keyboard parts, but rather to run live instruments through the filters. And if you listen to the album that we made at the time that I engineered, it was called Will of the Wisp. And this is where we had his songs. I think it was Hummingbird. Bluebird. I forgot the songs on it. But there's lots of examples of filtering of live instrument sounds like guitar or piano or drums and used as a creative instrument. So that took a $20,000 synthesizer at the time. But I thought, I always loved to play guitar and have it filtered rhythmically. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could make a low-cost stomp box for guitar players that would have all those synthesizer modules and be able to produce those same sounds, but without requiring the technical skill to patch everything up. And so the Adrenaline basically inside had a number of types of filters. It had envelope generators, it had envelope followers, different things that you'd use to affect a signal. And it also had a beat sync delay and had a little drum machine in it. So all you had to do was just play guitar into it and start a beat on it. And you could play something that you had in mind, but weren't too excited about it. And this would make it more exciting. And this is exactly what happened within a year of its release. The guitarist John Mayer was writing a song he had called, I don't know if it was a riff he had, but he started playing with Adrenaline, and he said in an interview somewhere that it really excited him. It inspired him to come up with this idea for a song, which he called Bigger Than My Body. And it became a hit. And if you listen to the song, there's this one looping Adrenaline filter sequence playing in sync to the beat all the way through the song, and the drummer is playing the same beat that was on the Adrenaline. So, and yes, it's a very good song, and he did that with two more hits too. So he really liked the Machine.
Did you have the idea for that before you did your new company, or was the new company and you said, okay, I need some products? How did that work?
Well, no, it was the first product. Adrenaline was the first product of Roger Lynn Design. Yeah, it was the impetus to form a new company.
Yeah. Okay, so then you brought out a new version of the MPC with the Tempest, right?
Well, it's not a new version of the MPC. It's a drum machine. But whereas the MPC was all based on sampled sounds, Tempest is a collaboration between me and Mr. Analog Synth Dave Smith, who's an old friend of mine. We've known each other for probably 35 years. And Dave's specialty is analog synthesis, and my specialty is drum machines. So Tempest is an analog drum machine. And so it does have a lot of samples built in. It has about 450 samples, fixed samples, but they're just used as sound sources, and they still have all the filters and the VCAs and the envelope generators and all that stuff that synthesis like.
Yeah. Okay, so then we come up to the big one, the Linstrument, which, what an amazing instrument that is.
Thank you.
I mean, it's incredible. So how did you think of this? I mean, there's nothing like it out there.
Well, there's actually four things kind of like it out there. And the class of instruments is called expressive MIDI controllers. Whoops, I just lost an earpiece. The idea of it is electronic music, which is very, very popular now, for pop records all the way down to everything else, or all the way up to everything else, should I say, it's all performed or largely performed with a MIDI keyboard. Now, if you think about it, a MIDI keyboard, MIDI piano keyboard, is basically a big array of on-off switches. Now, it does sense how hard you hit the on switch, other than that, it really doesn't do much more. You know, you've got a couple of sideways turn potentiometers on the left cheek block where you can bend the pitch with your finger in a very unnatural way or add a mathematically perfect vibrato. But other than that, it doesn't do much. I mean, you can sense a little bit of pressure after you've pressed the key all the way down. If you mash it down further, it gives you a little more pressure, but it's useless because you've already turned on the note. And so I said, what can I do to make this better? And once again, revolutions are often evolutions. I was the third person to come along with such an idea, or actually the fourth. The first one was a very, very creative fellow named Professor Lippold Hawken, and he made a device that was first released in 1999 called the Continuum Fingerboard. And after that came an interesting device out of London, or out of England, called the Eigenharp, and there are a few others. But what is common to all these instruments, including the Linstrument, is that they're not just on-off switches, but rather they sense three dimensions of your finger movement. And what this means, let me explain, is that you can vary the volume of a note, the loudness of a note, by the pressure of your finger. You can perform a vibrato or a pitch bend just by wiggling your finger left and right. For example, if you want to bend up from a C to a D, you put your finger on the C notepad and you slide it up to a D notepad. And if you want to then gradually work in a vibrato at the end of that, you just wiggle your finger left and right and you have a vibrato, just as you would with a violin or a cello. And then the third dimension is the Y-axis, and this is front to back finger movement. And what this does is alters the timbre of the instrument. So in practical use, I might play a little melody on an instrument, and if I have a violin sound, I can change the bow pressure by varying my finger pressure. I can change the pitch and add vibrato, or slide from note to note by sliding my finger left to right, note to note. And then if I want to change the timbre, for example, bowing near the bridge or bowing near the neck, I can move my finger forward or backward. And this is all happens polyphonically for all notes. And so these instruments are called expressive instruments because they give you actual musical expression, which is completely missing in MIDI keyboards.
Yeah.
And so it's a tremendous boon. And I'd like to say something more about this, and it's particularly appropriate for your your podcast. About a month ago, I went on the Billboard site. You know, they have the Billboard Top 100, of course. And I listened to the top 20 songs in the Top 100. 18 of them were electronically generated. Those same 18, not a single one of them had an instrumental solo. The only two of the top 20 that had an instrumental solo were ones using old acoustic instruments, right? And one of them was, for example, Justin Bieber's song called Love Yourself, and he has a trumpet solo where the trumpet plays the melody without any improvisation for 8 bars, and then another 8 bars where it does the same thing but with a harmony line above it. Mm-hmm. But the whole concept of an instrumental solo has virtually disappeared. And I think the world of popular music, the listeners have collectively voted, we don't think that an electronically synthesized voice is compelling enough to take a time out from the vocal. Now, you might ask yourself, does anybody care about expression anymore? But I argue they do, because the voices are marvelously expressive. There are some wonderful singers out there in the top 20. And they have wonderful expression. Over time, they vary the dynamics and the pitch. They do vibratos and all the sorts of things, the gestures of the voice that any good singer would do. So I think people value expression, but they don't value it with synthesized instrumental voices because everyone's playing them with on-off switches. And so I think that it's, in my view, this new class of instruments called the expressive instruments is the next revolution in performance of electronic music.
Yeah, but not only that, the way it can emulate traditional instruments. Traditional sounds. On one of your demos, it sounded so much like a steel guitar. And actually, you're doing things that you couldn't do on a steel, but it still sounded like a steel. And then there was another one where you did the same thing with the harp. The blues harp with the harmonica. Mm-hmm. Sounded great. Violin as well. I mean, all those things, just incredible. Blows my mind. If this doesn't catch on as the next new thing, then I don't think we're looking in the right place. Because really, as you say, it's a new class of instruments, and it's something that's definitely worth everybody taking a look at. How long was the development of the instrument?
It was about 4 years in development, and I had to develop my own custom sensing surface for it, and it took a lot of refinement, and I wanted to make something that didn't cost, you know, $5,000 or $6,000. So I was also trying to make something that isn't too expensive, and the instrument costs $1,500. That's the street price on it. So it's affordable, but it's on the borderline. You know, it'd be better if I could make it for $1,000, but it's expensive to do this sensor. And it took a long time to refine it and to get it right until it felt very sensitive to the touch. It could respond in all three dimensions independently and with high precision. But finally, I got it there, so it works out very well now.
Do you have dealers, or is it all direct?
I have both. People can either buy it directly from my online store on my website, or they can buy it from a dealer. Basically, it's always this, just about the same price. I suppose if you buy from a dealer, the dealer has the option to give you a discount, but generally they don't have to because they sell pretty well. And I've sold so far in the past, about a year and a quarter, I've sold 650 so far.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is very, very nice.
Very cool.
You know, what's very, very good too is that the people who buy an instrument tend to be more idea people. Either with a MIDI keyboard or with a some sort of a pad controller or something like that, on-off switches, knobs, and sliders, and they don't really see the merit in it. And on the other hand, a lot of traditional musicians who have great skill, they're not as interested in synthesis. They want to play the acoustic instrument. You know? So it's a little bit of a uphill battle. I'm always trying to present its merits to people and get them to open their mind to a new idea. But the beauty of it is that you know, there are tremendous advantages to playing electronic sound with an instrument. For example, I can get a beautiful violin sound, but I don't have to play as precisely as a violinist. On the instrument, its surface is comprised of a 200 little 3/4-inch square silicon rubber note squares, and they're laid out in 25 columns of 8 rows. And that basically is kind of like any stringed instrument. So each one of each one of the rows is like a string with consecutive semitones as you move up. And then you can tune, like you can tune strings, you can tune the rows however you want. And you can tune it like guitar or a cello or violin. And so it's if you press your finger on one of these squares, this is where I was going with this, you can press your finger anywhere within that 3/4-inch square and it'll be in perfect tune. And then, so it's kind of like having frets, right? But once you touch the note, it electronically takes the frets away. Then you can vibrato or you can slide and it will no longer quantize your pitch. So it quantizes it at the right times, but doesn't at the right times. And so it makes it much easier. I tried to play a violin, and it was very disconcerting to the people in my immediate vicinity. And so it's but I love the sound of a violin, and on Linstrument I can play the violin and make it sound, as you say, from listening to the recordings of it, I can make it sound very convincing. Perhaps not as good as Christian Tetzlaff, but I can pull it off pretty well.
How do most people play it? Do they play it laying flat or over their shoulders like a guitar?
Well, most people play it on a table. And just to give your listeners an idea, the instrument is, it's about 22.5 inches wide, about 8.5 inches deep front to back, and it's only 1 inch thin, and it's only about 5 pounds. So you can set it in front of you on a desk and play it as one would with a MIDI keyboard, or it's so light and small that it comes with 4 guitar strap pins in the corners, and you can put on a guitar strap and hold it standing up. Now, you wouldn't hold it like a guitar because there is no strumming surface. It's all notes that you play directly. But what people who play it standing up tend to do is to hold it kind of like the Chapman stick.
Yeah.
So you hold it at an angle that's more vertical, kind of like how Bill Wyman used to play bass.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
And that way you can reach both hands around its surface and play them. And the interesting thing about it, too, is that each one of the 200 silicon rubber 3/4-inch square notepads on the surface that are arranged like a stringed instrument, each one of them has a multicolor light underneath it. And so it lights up where the natural notes are in the same way that a piano would highlight the natural notes, the white keys in front. And then if the note is the same as a black key note, an accidental, it would not light that. So you can instantly see where all the natural notes are, and the C within each octave is lit in a different color. So it shows you exactly where the start of each octave is and makes it very easy to see.
I know I haven't played it, but I looked at the demo and I thought, okay, I think I can get this. I understand completely. So if you play a stringed instrument, it's quite natural.
Yes, and to the listening audience, I'm Bobby and I actually have a video link here, and I'm seeing behind him a rack of guitars.
Yeah, right.
So he understands stringed instruments.
Yeah, definitely.
If I can make a small plug, if anybody would like to see the video to which Bobby was referring, you can just go to my website, which is www.roger, R-O-G-E-R, Lynn, L-I-N-N, design, D-E-S-I-G-N.com. And there'll be a big picture of the instrument right on the front page. If you click that, it'll take you to another page that has a very nice video. It's only 8 minutes long, and it gives you a good overview of all the different sounds and shows you where the notes are and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's very effective. It shows you how it works as well, and shows you just about everything you need to know about it. So good job on that, too, because as we know, sometimes demos are counterproductive, shall we say, but not this one. This is very thorough. It's great. Okay, last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either learned along the way or maybe someone imparted to you?
Oh, geez. I'm not sure. You know, I was never that much of a businessman, and I'm still not. I think it would probably be something like find out who you are and make sure your business reflects who you are. I don't really like running a big company. When I had my first company, I had as many as 55 employees, and it was just chaos. And I like, at heart, I'm more the musician. You know, I like to make my own, instead of making songs now and song demos or making recordings, I'm making instruments, and I'd like to work alone. So I actually have no employees. But what I do have is I have a company I work with that does all the manufacturing for me. And then I have some people that help me out with the software or other things sometimes when I don't have the time. But it's very scalable. and also coming from being a musician, scalability is important because there are lean times and there are good times.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's good to be able to not have heavy expenses when things are not moving along so well. So I think that's the thing, is find out who you are and structure your business around what you want to do with your time, because you are going to be doing that with your time. It reminds me of the expression, somebody said, if you own your own business, you work half days, 12 hours.
Yeah.
Or another one was good. Somebody said the other day, they said, if you own your own business, you get to choose when you want to work. You can pick any 18 hours that you want per day to work.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. How true, how true. Yes, but if you love it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't
That's
matter.
That's true. You're getting paid for your hobby, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. This has been great, Roger. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bobby.
To find out more about Roger and his Linstrument, go to rogerlindesign.com. It's all one word, Roger Lynn, L-I-N-N, design.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.